This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. The nation is engaged in a spirited presidential election season. In the Democratic camp, matters of race have arisen, with Barack Obama potentially becoming the first African-American president. In as many as 5 states, one aspect of race could also be on voters' minds this fall: whether to ban affirmative action in their states. Opponents of affirmative action have enough signatures to put the question on the ballot in Colorado, and petition drives are underway for similar referendums in Arizona, Missouri, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. All of these initiatives are being led by Ward Connerly, the country's most prominent opponent of affirmative action, who says one's race should not be taken into account at hiring time or when students are admitted to colleges. In Connerly's view, the current Democratic primary shows that considerations of race and gender are no longer needed to compensate for institutional racism or sexism. Marvin Krizlov disagrees. When he was the general counsel for the University of Michigan, he coordinated that school's defense of its affirmative action policy in a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Krizlov most recently argued for affirmative action during a debate with Ward Connerly at the City Club of Cleveland this month. And it's that debate we'll hear this hour on Word for Word, along with comments the two made later in a question and answer session. Ward Connerly is chairman of the American Civil Rights Institute. He is also a member of the University of California Board of Regents. Marvin Krizlov is now president of Oberlin College. The City Club debate was moderated by Jeffrey Mearns, dean of the Cleveland Marshall College of Law. Marvin Krizlov gave the first opening statement at the April 1st event.
I'd like to talk about 3 things today. 1, our ideals; 2, our present; and 3, our future. Our ideals. In 1954, the Supreme Court set forth a vision in Brown v. Board of Ed of an integrated school, an integrated community. And today, over 50 years later, we are still struggling with that. Today, in many parts of the United States, we are more segregated than we were in 1954. And as the Kerner Commission, the redo of the Kerner Commission, recently came out and said, there are huge educational and income disparities between people from different backgrounds and people from different races. What are the barriers? The barriers are continued residential segregation, and the barriers are also inequities in schooling. Just today, I read in the newspaper that in the Cleveland public school district, 34% of people graduate from high school, whereas in our suburban high schools, 78% of the people graduate. These are just some of the criteria that show us the discrepancies. But because affirmative action, and that is the topic of today's debate, is often viewed as one based simply on race, I want to make a point at the very beginning, which is that the greatest beneficiaries of affirmative action actually have been white women, and that there are still inequities regarding women, their access to certain professions, their salaries, and so forth. So when we think about affirmative action as a policy issue, let's not just simply paint it as an issue of race, but we should think about gender as well. Our present. Affirmative action has been a modest tool at giving opportunities to people, particularly in areas such as higher education. Admissions, financial aid programs, mentoring and support programs that are targeted either to women or underrepresented minorities have been responsible for the success of many people, including, I suspect, many of you here today. Successive administrations, both Republican and Democratic, have endorsed the notion of properly tailored affirmative action programs. In 2003, the Supreme Court considered the contours of higher education affirmative action programs and gave us a blueprint for how to figure out how to take race and ethnicity into account, as well as all the other criteria: athletic prowess, talents, socioeconomic status, and so forth. That has been a blueprint for enabling a certain number of qualified minorities and or women to achieve access to excellence. It's also been a recipe for excellent education, because as the Supreme Court found, a diverse education, a diverse background is essential to providing an excellent education. And of course, this is the dream. This is the dream of Brown v. Board of Ed. It is the dream that we as America are still struggling to achieve over 50 years later. What has happened in those places that have chosen to eliminate affirmative action as a tool has been very, very detrimental. There's a study called Killing Affirmative Action by Ellis Coase, a Newsweek reporter, and he talks about the very significant drop in enrollment of underrepresented minorities at places like Berkeley and UCLA, the highly selective schools. He shows that in 1998, the year after Prop 209 was put into effect, in some places there was one African-American in a law school class. Even today, over a decade later, some of those law schools, some of those undergrad student bodies have not rebounded in terms of underrepresented minorities. This in a state, California, our most significantly minority population state with a growing minority population. This is not appropriate or helpful to our dream, our American dream, and it is not helpful to providing the kind of excellent education that schools like Berkeley and UCLA care about. Our future. There was an alliance that came before the Supreme Court, an alliance of business people, an alliance of religious leaders, an alliance of the military, and they came before the Supreme Court in 2003. In fact, it's ironic because April 1st was the day that we actually had the oral argument at the Supreme Court. So this is April 1st, 5 years later. But that alliance of amici, friends of the court, came before the court and talked about the importance of having an integrated educational experience in terms of both business and the military, as well as other issues, because of the pipeline and because of the importance of diversity. This alliance should be talking about what are the real barriers to achieving the American dream. This alliance should be talking about issues like segregation in residential living, but more importantly, should be banding together to talk about the pipeline, to talk about the inequities in high school. Frankly, what I wish the City Club was doing today was not talking about affirmative action, because it is a modest tool. It is a modest tool that has been effective, but the City Club should be talking about what is most important, perhaps, the pipeline issue. The fact that many young people today are growing up in very segregated communities, in communities that they have no access to people from other races and backgrounds, and that they don't have opportunity. Because opportunity is what schooling is all about and what the pipeline to higher education provides. Justice O'Connor for the court said, "Effective participation by members of all racial and ethnic groups in the civic life of our nation is essential if the dream of one nation indivisible is to be realized." Affirmative action helps provide one tool. It is not the only tool, and some would say it is not even the most important tool. But if we shut it down, I shudder to think about our chances of achieving the America we all want to live in.
Thank you, Mr. Krizlov. Mr. Connerly?
It's a great pleasure to be able to visit with you about one of the most contentious subjects in American life, race, how we deal with it. I think that there is hardly a program or a concept that is more poorly served by the debate than the issue of, quote, affirmative action. It's an amorphous term. It comes in many forms. There are some forms that I support strongly. But I think that the era of race-based affirmative action is coming to an end. It is going to end. And the reason is that it's incompatible with the basic tenets of American life. Treat other people the way you want to be treated. Don't judge them on the basis of race. Not judge them on the basis of race, but don't judge them on the basis of race. If we're talking about affirmative action as John F. Kennedy fashioned it, namely, a concept to ensure that there was no discrimination, that should live through time immemorial. If we're talking about affirmative action as a means of making sure that we provide assistance to those students or applicants who have never had a parent go to college, that should live If we're talking about affirmative action as a means of helping low-income students, whatever their color, that should live. But if we're talking about affirmative action as a system of treating people differently, which is what most universities use, different standards based on your, quote, race, whatever that means in this year 2008, that form of affirmative action has no place in American life or law. It was John F. Kennedy who said in 1961, race has no place in American life or law. And if we're trying to forge a society in which people are judged on the basis of what they bring as individuals, then I think that the concept of herding us all into five food groups and deciding who gets what on the basis of where we fit in that system, that concept is going to end, and it should end. Now, let's talk a little bit about what has happened in California since the president made reference to it. Yes, in the immediate aftermath of the passage of Proposition 209, the number of black students at Berkeley and UCLA plummeted. But as a result of the actions that we took within the system to redefine the concept of merit from one in which we conferred benefits solely on the basis of somebody's ethnicity or gender or race or color, but rather one into which we looked at students comprehensively. What schools did they attend? How many honors courses were offered at those schools? How many did they take? What's their economic background? What kind of social conditions did they have? When we redefined our affirmative action program on that basis, within the overall UC system, the number of, quote, underrepresented minorities, the percentage went up. Not just the number, the percentage went up. And it demonstrates that we can indeed reach that place that the Supreme Court and Justice O'Connor, whom the president mentioned, aspired that in 25 years we would reach that point of race-neutral affirmative action. That's where we're headed, my friends. We're trying to evolve a system in this country in which we provide access to people who otherwise wouldn't have it, not just on the basis of race, but access to people who otherwise wouldn't have it. The Supreme Court was right last year. We should not be so preoccupied with integration that we ignore the importance of giving kids who are going to predominantly black schools a better education. I think that we have failed in our concern about integration. We have been so concerned about that over the years that we have destroyed black neighborhoods, we've destroyed black schools, we do not provide the infrastructure, we do not provide the quality of education for these kids in their schools so that parents can be close to them. We've been more concerned about having a black kid sit next to a white kid, and I think in the process we have paid a dear price for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Connerly. Mr. Krizlov, I believe you have 2 minutes.
The system that was approved by the Supreme Court in 2003 was a holistic system that included the criterion of academic achievement as the primary one, but also issues such as legacy, athletics, socioeconomic status, and so forth. That is the system that a well-devised legal affirmative action program considers. So if one says that people were separated into buckets, that's simply not reflecting what the Supreme Court said, and it's frankly not even reflecting what the Supreme Court said in 1978 in the Bakke decision, because the Bakke decision made it very clear that everyone had to be in the same pool, that you couldn't have quotas and you couldn't have set-asides. And any university that had any sort of guidance would have known that that is not the way to do admissions. So let's not talk about a situation that really hasn't existed for at least a quarter of a century. Let's talk about an admission system that considers many different criteria, many different considerations, and looks holistically at the whole person. California, and that's the second point, California, the system, largely due to the benefit of its burgeoning minority population, may have increased underrepresented minorities, but in the flagship universities, Berkeley and UCLA, the number continues to be down from what it was in 1998. And it is so upsetting to the leadership of the UC system that they just recently had a meeting and said, we don't know what to do. All the workarounds we've done have not worked. In fact, they've created a separate foundation outside of the UC system to provide scholarships for African-American students because the UC system has determined that because of the law, it can't provide scholarships targeted at African-American students. So even if the people in this room wanted to give money to help African-American students, you'd have to do a workaround. So let's be clear that the California future is not the future that we want, and it is not a future that makes a lot of sense if we are to achieve our American dream.
Thank you. And Mr. Connerly, thank you, Mr. Kristoff. Mr. Connerly, you have 3.5 minutes.
Let's be honest about the nature of the problem that we faced. The president talked about the pipeline. Yeah, we've got a problem in the pipeline. It doesn't begin at the admissions office of the university. It begins when a child is born. Whether the parents read to that child, the quality of the K-12 school that that child attends. University administrators want to correct this problem on the cheap. They want to correct it when somebody is admitted and give out a little few points here and few points there to try to make sure that they have their precious diversity. That doesn't solve the problem. The academic gap between black kids and white kids and increasingly between Asian kids and everybody else is growing. It's not that the University of California, where I sat as a 12-year sentence as a regent, it's not that we are discriminating against people on the basis of race. We want the students. Problem is that there is a gap in academic accomplishment, and we have to solve that gap. We don't do it with a stroke of the pen and say, let's just give some extra points and make sure that we have diversity. Get serious about closing the gap. And that means better outreach programs. It means reading to our kids at an early age to make sure that they appreciate the learning process, to make sure that they can compete on their own. And that's what we're going to have to do as we evolve a new approach to affirmative action. There's no silver bullet here, folks. There's no easy solution by simply saying, let's give affirmative action. Oh, my God, the numbers went down at Berkeley and UCLA. Yeah, but the important thing is that the retention gap that we had before we eliminated preferences, that gap is closing. We had a 40% gap between underrepresented students and Asians and whites before we eliminated preferences. That gap is closing. The graduation gap is closing. The number of black kids graduating from UC San Diego has doubled because they're going where they're economically competitive rather than going on the basis of where administrators want them to go so that they can have diversity. So I would submit to you that we are in a very critical stage in this country in trying to fashion a new approach to affirmative action. The old one hasn't worked. We've had it for 40 years. The Bakke decision, they talked about using race. The Grutter decision, they talked about using race. It hasn't worked. You can find token examples of where it's worked. But for the masses, it hasn't worked. And so I think that the preferred approach is to fashion affirmative action on the basis of socioeconomic conditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connerly. It's now my opportunity to ask a few questions of our guests here today. I'm going to direct a question to one of you, and I'll ask that you limit your response to about a minute, and then the other person will have approximately 30 seconds to respond. Mr. Kristoff, if I could begin with a question first to you, sir. Some people in higher education admissions say, and they say this only when they feel free to speak candidly, that affirmative action programs make them dissemblers. We all claim publicly that race is just one factor in admissions, but some studies suggest, and some admissions officers concede privately, that race is the determining factor. Don't affirmative action programs corrupt the very institutions that should be the models of honesty and integrity?
Well, I can tell you that at the institutions I've been at, I'm very proud of what we've achieved in terms of having a properly devised affirmative action program. And by that, I mean that academic achievement is by far and away the most important criterion. No one is admitted who can't do the work, because that wouldn't be the right thing to do for anybody. But there are other criteria that do come into play. frankly, things like geographic consideration. Socioeconomic consideration has been and continues to be an important criterion at any school that I'm aware of. It's not a matter of one or the other. Socioeconomic continues to be very important. Socioeconomic cannot carry the weight, though, if one wants to have racial and ethnic diversity, because the simple fact is that there are more poor Caucasian people in this country than there are people who are African American or Latino. But I can tell you that affirmative action in admissions, it takes one factor among many. It is looking at a very select, a highly capable group. It is not major social uplift. And anyone who thinks that it is mistaken about what the nature of a modern-day affirmative action looks like.
Thank you. Mr. Connerly?
Well, it has been the factor. At Berkeley, for example, and at UCLA, we get between 46 and 51,000 applicants every year, competing for about 4,200 seats. We could fill every seat and never get below 4.2. or 1480 out of 1600 on the SAT. That's how competitive it is. So how do we make students who are 780 on the SAT, C minus competing against 4.2, how do we make them competitive unless we do it on the natural? What we're trying to do is effectively to do that, and I'm being choked off here. So,
well, we'll give you a chance to keep going in just a moment. Let me ask then, Mr. Connerly, a question of you. And let me just begin with a little personal background as the setup for the question. My father went to Yale undergrad and then to the University of Virginia Law School. I went to Yale undergrad and then to the University of Virginia Law School. And had I not been a legacy, I'm not sure I would have gotten into either institutions. So if colleges and universities are permitted to continue preferential admissions policies that benefit privileged white men like me, why shouldn't those same institutions also be permitted to have preferential admissions policies that benefit historically disadvantaged minorities?
Colleges shouldn't have legacy admissions, in my view, especially public ones. You shouldn't have gone there.
That's what some of the professors said, too.
I think it's very elitist. Apart from the issue of race, I think it's very elitist for public institutions to be giving some preference to the son or daughter of someone rather than on the basis of that student's merit. And the first thing I did as a regent after we eliminated the consideration of race was to eliminate legacy admissions at the University of California. I think they have no place in a public institution.
Mr. Krizlov?
Well, the notion of merit is one that is highly contested, and some people would argue that things like standardized tests are not accurate measures of merit. Some people would argue that different grades at different schools matter. And some people would argue that it matters a lot if you had to do 20 hours of week work as well as trying to attend classes, and if you had a difficult family situation or you had suffered discrimination or prejudice. What the system of affirmative action that should be practiced in higher education is one that looks holistically at individuals and all the factors of their lives.
Thank you, Mr. Krizlov. Question for you, if I may. If race is a factor, then it's possible that children of well-educated, wealthy, minority African-American parents can receive preferential admissions treatment in education at the expense of a poor white child who's trying to become the first person in her family to attend college. Why is that fair?
Well, it goes back to what I just said. The notion of merit and admissions is not one, it's not an either or. Admissions at the schools that I'm familiar with are not, there's not a rank ordering. It's composing a class. And one of the things that's important is to have a mix of people. People from rural, people from urban, people with interest in biology, people interested in the arts, people who are athletes, people who are music people. And so this notion of a one for one is simply not reflective of the way admissions is practiced at affirmative action-oriented or schools that I'm aware of.
Mr. Connerly?
It's true that it's not a one-for-one, but again, the demand for college admissions so far outstrips the supply of seats that it does end up being a situation in which admissions people have to make choices. And those choices, when they are concerned about diversity, those choices ultimately end up being choices made on the basis of race. And all I am urging is that we take race out of the equation. All of the other things that the good president talks about are certainly desirable. We want a diverse student body. But diversity is not, should not be, defined by race. It's all of the other factors that should go into that admissions decision.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question. Mr. Connerly, and if I may direct this last question to you.
Yes, sir.
You said during your remarks that affirmative action programs should end, and they need to end in order to actually promote further racial equality in the United States. Well, if I can be blunt, what if you're wrong? I mean, what if affirmative action is helping to keep a lid on racial tension in America? Many people here in Cleveland remember quite vividly and quite painfully the civil rights riots of the 1960s. And so what if affirmative action is helping to keep a lid on those tensions and prevent that in the future? Shouldn't we err on the side of caution of maintaining a program that might actually be helping to promote racial peace and racial equality?
I think one of the greatest disservices to, quote, affirmative action is it gets credit for a lot of things it didn't deserve. To be certain, there have been a number of individuals who have been brought into the mainstream by affirmative action who otherwise may not have been. But I think that, and I think our society has benefited from it, but I think that more than anything else, eliminating the barriers so that people like yours truly and other, quote, people of color could compete. It's the removal of the barriers, I think, that has built the black middle class, not the largesse of a benevolent white society that has made it. Eliminate the barriers and most of us can compete. If we are prepared, if we go to school, get an education, we can compete. Affirmative action is not the be-all and end-all, and if you remove it, society is not going to come to an end. Black people are not going to be out there standing on the street corners with cardboard signs saying, we will work for food. We'll be all right. We'll be great. So I don't think that affirmative action is that crutch that some believe it is, or that our society will socially come unraveled without it.
Mr. Krizloff.
I worry about the students who have gone to Berkeley and UCLA during this period who say to me that they feel cheated because they did not have a diverse educational experience, that they did not learn the skills of working with people from different backgrounds. And I worry that if we do not provide that kind of diverse, excellent education, that we will be cheating our country as well, out of a whole workforce of people who know how to work together with people from different backgrounds. There's a book by Scott Page of the University of Michigan that talks about the strength that comes from having a diverse team and a diverse group of individuals.
Marvin Krizloff, president of Oberlin College and former vice president and general counsel at the University of Michigan, where he orchestrated the school's defense of its affirmative action policy before the U.S. Supreme Court. On April 1st at the City Club of Cleveland, he again debated the issue with affirmative action opponent Ward Connerly, who is a member of the University of California Board of Regents and chairman of the American Civil Rights Institute. Moderating the debate was Jeffrey Mearns, dean of the Cleveland Marshall College of Law. You're hearing the debate on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After the formal debate, the two speakers took questions from the audience.
Mr. Krizloff, it seems to me that diversity in education is a good thing. As you noted, putting people of different backgrounds together is a good thing, rich with poor, urban, suburban. As you said, biologists with artists or musicians with athletes. The troubling implication of that, it seems to me, is that when we say putting different people together is a good thing, do you think that on the basis of the color of their skin that African Americans are different than whites? And is not that the implication of Michigan's policy?
Thank you for that question. People of color may or may not have had a different experience of life than people who are not of color. They can't discover that unless they get to know each other. And one of the reasons why it's important to have a critical mass of underrepresented students is so that people can understand, people from, let's say, a majority group, can understand that not all African Americans are alike, that Mr. Connerly and Goody Marshall, who's a friend of mine, have very different views. And that's okay. So the point is that there is something that may lead one to believe something or act in a particular way. But the truth is that the experience of being a person of color in this country may, in fact, be very different than being Jewish or being Catholic or someone may be Jewish and a person of color. And it is important to have these various experiences and these various backgrounds reflected in our student body so that we can both discover the sameness, the differences, and the confusions in all these areas.
Mr. Connerly, would you like an opportunity to comment?
I often wonder who's of color, who's not of color. I think we're all of color of some sort. If you look at Morehouse and Howard University, they're probably 95 or 90% black. Dr. King went to Morehouse. They provide a good product. May not be, in some mind, comparable to Oberlin, but it's a pretty good product. And I don't think that they suffer because there aren't a lot of white kids there. Teachers are pretty good. The students are all different. If there are 50,000 of them there, they're all different. They come from different parts of the globe, different experiences. We have to rethink this whole business about integration.
Okay, Mr. Connelly, this is a two-part question. The first part question is, do you agree or disagree with W.E.B. Du Bois talking about the talented 10th lead the race of black folks and the souls of black folks? Do you agree or disagree with that? The second part of this question is, there's a severe amount of underemployment within the black community where you have black people of color, blacks who have educations, but are stuck in a rut where just from a human resources standpoint, that you have a large percentage of people who are stuck in line employment positions, but however, you have a shortfall of people that's not available to the information as far as moving to a staff employment position, whereas companies are having a large struggle as far as retention of employees. Well, affirmative action programs has been a benefit of helping companies with diversity as far as retention of these employees as we can continue to build up black middle class. What's your comment on that, please?
Thank you. First of all, I don't agree with W.E.B. Du Bois's talented top 10th. I think not in today's environment. I think that when we were looking at opening the doors and trying to seed different venues of American life, I think there was a lot of relevance to that theory. Now I think that it has outlived its usefulness. Now we need to start worrying about the masses. We have to worry about what we can do to transform our society so that a lot of the people who are low income, stuck in zones of depression, who can't find a way out of that we can help them. I think our focus needs to be not on the top 10th. We need to be focusing on what we can do to help those who don't have an education, who are caught up in a lousy criminal justice system that doesn't only cheat black people, but whites as well, low-income people. We need to start transforming the system so that more people who are outside that system can participate. Now, the second part of your question, the economy is not serving right now a lot of people. There are a lot of people on the basis of who are stuck in the economy, and not just black people. The second part of your question about affirmative action lifting up blacks within employment areas who have no place to go. One of the tragedies, I think, of affirmative action is that it marginalizes people. And a lot of companies, and I've served on a lot of corporate boards, a lot of companies have the notion that they will hire a woman or they'll hire a black person or increasingly a Latino so that they can have diversity. But in their mind, there's still a notion that that person has a certain role to perform, human resources role, some sort of affirmative action position in their mind. The person is not free to move around within that company and to move up because of that stereotype, because of the marginalization that has occurred. And so one of the things that seems to me that has to evolve here is that we have to change that stereotype that all black people are somehow beneficiaries of affirmative action. That's the real challenge that I think has to occur.
Mr. Krizlov, would you like to comment on those answers?
No,
you don't have to. Okay. Yes, sir.
Mr. Krizlov, at the beginning of this discussion, there was a reference to a Supreme Court case in June. I believe that was the parents involved in community schools versus Seattle School District. And there were three sentences that Chief Justice Roberts said in there I'd like to ask for you to respond to. He said, the 14th Amendment prevents states from according differential treatment to American children on the basis of their color or race. He then says, before Brown, school children were told where they could and could not go to school based on the color of their skin. I think we all agree that was wrong. He then concludes, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that opinion was dealing with a K-12 system that created tiebreakers in Seattle and Louisville based on race. And we can debate the merits of that decision, but the point of that decision was to reaffirm the Grutter-Gratz holdings that a holistic form of admissions that looked at race and ethnicity as one factor among many was perfectly constitutional. That's the clear message coming out of there. And in fact, the criticism of the K-12 systems were that they were not as well organized, if you will, or holistic in terms of comprehensively looking at individuals' backgrounds.
Mr. Connerly?
No.
Now, first of all, I just want to thank both of you for enlightening insights on both sides. And my question is to Mr. Connerly, if I understood correctly when Mr. Krizloff was talking and listed a number of variables that he would consider or should be considered in admission, you agreed with all of them and said, except that you would rule out race. And so my question is one of how do you account for then the visibility factor that comes with race, and as a result of that, the social loadings that folks have that cannot be erased because how we're wired, and along with those social loadings, how it what's the relationship then that people have based on their race with America, and as a result of that relationship, the actions and everything else that comes with it, regardless of socioeconomic, education, et cetera, just based on visibility?
In 13 years, that's the best question I've ever had. There is a social loading in visibility. There is. No matter how much progress we seem to make in purging differences out of our society, the two that seem to haunt us are color and sexual orientation for some people. So the question then on the issue of visibility, color, is it possible for us to diffuse the relevance of color? I believe it is. I believe it is. As we look at the nation and we see that people are marrying across lines of race, they're interacting across lines of race, they're going to sporting events together, they're in business together. I'm a very optimistic person. Of course, I think I can grow hair every day too, but I'm optimistic that we can, in fact, make race less relevant. And that's the conundrum about the pursuit of diversity, because we don't make it less relevant. We make it more relevant. So I think that the visibility issue goes as we change the policies and make race, whatever that means, but color, less relevant.
Thank you, Mr. Connerly. Mr. Krizloff?
Well, I don't think I can grow hair. I discovered when I was a senior in college that it was going, and it was only going in one direction. And that's one reason why when we think about where we are in this country, I think it's important to think about where we would like to be, but I think it's also important to consider where we are. And I heard a lady to my left saying gender, gender, gender. And I do think that anyone who thinks that while we're making progress, we've achieved what we need to do in terms of equality and opportunity for women and underrepresented minorities, I don't think the statistics bear that out. And that's why I think it's important to preserve the modest, and I would say admittedly modest, tool that affirmative action can provide.
Good afternoon, Mr. Connerly. If you hang out in Cleveland long enough, you might see everybody outside with a cardboard sign talking about we need work. Question I have for you is, to put yourself in the situation, you're a black high school male senior with a 3.7 GPA, and your interest is biomechanical engineering, and you've just been denied admission to a public university. What would you do?
Well, first of all, I would try to find out why maybe I was denied that. And there are a lot of students with 3.7s and higher. And while I don't think that the standardized test ought to be everything, there are a lot of students with 1480s who are being denied over students with 780 and 1080 at Berkeley. So I try to find out what the competition is. The mere fact that I have 3.7 standing alone doesn't mean necessarily that I was the most competitive student. Doesn't mean that my life circumstances were such to catch the attention of the admissions people. There are a lot of things that are going on. I would also look at other colleges. One does not have to go to the most elite institutions in order to lead a productive life. I went to a community college. I went to a state college. And I can tell you that it was more important that I get an education than that I go to the University of California.
Mr. Krizlov, would you like to comment?
Well, what's interesting is that one of the reasons why the lawsuits and a lot of these controversies have come about is because people do believe that access to elite education matters a lot. And I think if you look at the literature on networking and social contacts, that is borne out. And so I have no idea about a particular individual's admission or non-admission. But I do think the concept of elite education as opening the doors of opportunity, doors that can be opened in other ways, but there is a particular way that elite education often does that. And Dean Mearns referred to that in his opening statement. If you look at some of the people who are in leadership, and that's what the Grutter case talks about, Justice O'Connor talked about the leadership that comes out of our nation's elite law schools, the senators, the judges, the power elite that comes out of elite education, the presidential candidates. I think it's hard to think that it doesn't make a huge difference.
Thank you, Mr. Krizlov. We have a question over here.
I don't consider myself a benevolent white, and I tried to listen to you both very hard. I'll tell you part of my background is I was a district exec for the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, but I don't remember if it was when you were working president there. I hear you both in agreement, except for one issue. I hear Marv saying we consider all criteria, and certainly when I worked with universities, they considered everything. I never said to a college, race Iberalis, never said race was the most important thing, but certainly to ignore race or sex as one of the criteria that we use in this country, I can't imagine. I hear you, sir, saying consider everything, but don't consider race. So am I hearing you right that you agree on everything you've said, except that you're saying race is not an issue at this time? Or am I misunderstanding you?
Mr. Connerly, why don't you start first?
I think you're hearing right. I have no problem with the admissions people using how gracefully one falls off a log, if that's what they want to use. But I have a problem with the university discriminating on the basis of race. And in my view, if you are, quote, considering race as one of many factors, you are discriminating. And I abhor discrimination. But I think that on the other things, we are agreeing.
Mr. Krizlov?
Well, this has devolved to a discussion about admissions, but I would also like to point out that there are a lot of other programs that are in play here, including financial aid, mentoring, outreach programs, and that in the state of California now, due to the high voltage decision by the California Supreme Court, targeting on the basis of race or gender, even for outreach programs, is now prohibited. So this notion of doing away with affirmative action as a policy really is a very blunt instrument in terms of shutting down the doors of opportunity. The other thing that comes out in the discussions in California is the message it sends, too. So there's the impact, the substantive impact, but then there's also the message that it sent to young people or women who are trying to get into these programs, the message that we're really not that interested because we're shutting down these programs and these efforts. And, you know, we can debate whether that was the intent or not, but that is the message that is being received.
You have a question over here, please.
There's a question about K through 12. You recall back in the 1970s, Judge Battisti ruled that the Cleveland school system be integrated by means of busing kids across town. And I believe as a result, many families of both races moved to the suburbs. My question to you is, did this overall result in a better school system in Cleveland or not? And was it the right thing to do at the time? I'd like to hear your comments.
Mr. Krizlov, you want to start first, please?
You know, I was in Lexington, Kentucky. I came and visited my family in Cleveland, but I have no knowledge of what happened in the 70s in Cleveland's school system. What I can tell you is that what we're talking about today is a very different policy. It's a policy of affirmative action, and I focus primarily on higher education because that's what I know about. My sense of K through 12 is there are other methods being tried today, such as magnets and so forth. But the challenge is, of course, that because of the jurisdictional lines, sometimes it's very difficult to achieve integration. But that's really not what I've been focused on right now.
And Mr. Connerly.
Let me first of all say that no opportunities are being taken away from anybody in California. We had a scholarship program for white women that wanted to go into nursing at Davis. And when 209 passed, we said, open that program up for anybody. Anybody that wants to go into nursing if it's public money. So nobody is being denied access. We're just expanding those programs. Integration, it seems to me, I mean, obviously segregation by the government was wrong. I don't think any right-thinking person will defend that. But it seems to me that rather than simply breaking up segregation, government-enforced segregation, we begin to think that we had to have government-enforced integration. And in the process of that, we destroyed black schools. Black kids are the ones who largely paid the price for busing these kids 45 miles away in many cases so that they could sit next to a white kid. And I think that in the fullness of time, we have realized that we did not improve the schools. We destroyed the schools.
Well, thank you all for your questions. It's now the opportunity for each of our distinguished guests to make some final comments. Given the time, I'm going to ask you each to limit it to about 90 seconds, if you can. We will proceed in the reverse order from the opening, so the closing order will be Mr. Connerly.
Well, thank you all very much for lending us your ear. This is a very contentious issue, and there are no losers in this debate if we all are certain about trying to move the ball up the field so that our society benefits from having more people participating. It's not easy to do that, however, but I think we can. Race, in my view, has no place in the interactions and the transactions of our people. We don't even know what race is in many cases. Visibility, but it's more than that. So I think that it's incumbent upon us to try to work together to find ways of making sure that those who need assistance get it. And in my view, the common denominator is income. We have a growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in our nation. And we need to focus on what we can do to improve low-income neighborhoods. What can we do to make sure that kids who are locked out have access? What can we do to make sure that contractors who don't have the capital, regardless of their color, have the ability to bid on jobs? We need to do all those things to make sure that we improve access, but not race.
Thank you, Mr. Connerly. And Mr. Krizlov.
We're making progress in this country, as Justice O'Connor talked about. It's probably not as much or not as fast as most of us would like to see.
for women, for underrepresented minorities, and for many other people as well. But look at California. What's happened in the decades since Prop 209 has not created a whole new regime of prosperity and color blindness and happiness. Instead, it's created a lot of upset, and it's marginalized African Americans and Latinos at some of the most prestigious colleges and universities in California. Affirmative action is a modest tool to try to provide opportunities to people who are underrepresented, either minorities or women. It is necessary but not sufficient. And that's why it would occur to me that instead of spending millions of dollars on ballot initiatives, the money and time that goes into those ballot initiatives might be better spent at actually doing the work, actually working to improve the public schools, actually working to improve the pipeline, working to improve those programs. If affirmative action programs aren't necessary, fine, eliminate them. But instead of spending all our time talking about what might be, let's talk about the ways that we can actually achieve the American dream and provide the equality and opportunity that many of us would have thought was promised in 1954. We are making progress, but we cannot fool ourselves into thinking that it doesn't take enormous commitment to try to make it even better.
That was Marvin Krizlov, president of Oberlin College and former vice president and general counsel at the University of Michigan. While at Michigan, he spearheaded the legal team that defended the school's affirmative action policy all the way to the Supreme Court in 2003. Ward Connerly is a member of the University of California Board of Regents and chairman of the American Civil Rights Institute. He is now leading efforts in five states to ban affirmative action and put the issue to voters in ballot initiatives this fall. The two men debated affirmative action at the City Club of Cleveland on April 1st. If you missed part of this hour's debate or you would like to hear it again, you may find it at our website. It's wordforword.org. When you go there, you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and take part in an online discussion about the ideas in this hour's program as well as those in previous programs. You may also search the Word for Word archives and listen to speakers such as Shelby Steele talking about race and Barack Obama, columnist Anthony Lewis on the history of the First Amendment, and Joseph Nye on leadership and power. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penn-Cava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.